Hello, everybody, and welcome to the Nutrition Network. And today we have with us Alex Manos, who is from Health Path. And welcome, Alex. How are you doing?
I'm very well, thank you, Kate. How are you?
I am fabulous. No, I'm sensational, nearly at 60. Can you believe it? So, yes, I know it's kind of a little hard to take in, but there you go. Luckily, the camera isn't very good on this. So, I've got a little bit of Vaseline on the lens to disguise that fact. Yeah. Anyway, so Alex, tell us a little bit about you, and then tell us a little bit about Health Path, and you know, and all of that sort of good thing.
Okay, so I guess starting from a current perspective, I am a functional medicine practitioner and nutritional therapist. So I've certified with the Institute for Functional Medicine. I got my master's in personalized nutrition at CNELM. I am where I am today because from a very, very young age, I had, as is often the story for nutritional therapists, my own health issues. So I struggled with gut symptoms from almost day one.
Day one of your life.
Day one of my life.
Oh yeah. My goodness, that's so early. Yeah.
So I had also just horrendous eczema. I'd be waking up in the morning and there'd be just sort of spots of blood on my skin from scratching myself all night. And I kind of just muddled my way through. And at 18, I received the diagnosis of IBS, which we know isn't particularly helpful ultimately. And it was when I started studying at ION, when I think I was 22, that I heard this concept of SIBO. I did a SIBO breath test at Biolab. Back then, there was no home SIBO test you could do. So it was going into London, sitting in their offices for 3 hours and kind of popping into the nurse's room every 20 minutes to take a breath sample. Understood that SIBO was contributing to my issues. And looking back, it's interesting because my first SIBO test then was a complete and utter flatliner. And obviously now we talk a lot about hydrogen sulfide and whether flatlining SIBO results could be as a result of that. So that kind of really, I think, just made me particularly interested in gut health.
So you sort of just, because you had the symptoms, you decided to study a 3-year course at ION, in effect.
I
did the same thing, which is I just sort of, we were just talking before we went live, which is actually I came from I didn't have anything going with my health at all, but it was really through a sort of like wanting to be like a personal development, sounds cheesy, but you know, wanting to be my best. So you know, the same for me. I just thought, oh yeah, this course looks fine, why don't you do this? You know, 3 years later I was like, you know what I mean, I didn't realize what I've got myself into. Yeah. Anyway, so tell me, how did you sort of decide to do that? It's quite a big step from just having a bit of IBS.
I was very fortunate. From I reckon 15 years old, I knew I wanted to be a personal trainer. So after university, the first thing I did was actually a 3-month diploma in personal training and sports massage therapy. I read Patrick Holford's book on gut health. That transforms my gut health. And obviously, you know, as with his link to ION, stumbled across ION, was like, I have to do this diploma. So it was actually through reading the book, experiencing the power of nutritional therapy, that I then wanted to add that to my kind of repertoire of kind of services.
Yeah, I think Patrick's been a bit of an inspiration, and you know, in he's still, you know, cracking the important issues of the day, you know, really. He is really amazing. And the same, funnily enough, although different, I read his Optimum Nutrition Bible, I think, and I can't remember if it said in the back or something, join this course. I thought, oh yeah, that's a good idea. So an inspiration really, Patrick, you know. Absolutely. Definitely. So, you know, but that's very early to, you know, 22, it's really young to start something. What were you working at alongside doing ION?
So I was basically building my personal training business. So I lived at home with my parents for actually most of my 20s. So I was building my business while studying at ION. And not only was I obviously probably the youngest there, but I think I was one of about 5 men as well. So I felt a little bit of an outsider, so to speak, going through those 3 years.
Why do you think that is? Because I mean, it was exactly all of our experiences, which is, it's basically you know, women who by and large, you know, with a very small minority of men.
Yeah. Well, I mean, we know that men are terrible when it comes to even kind of asking for help in health. You know, the number of kind of men who visit their GP with health issues is a lot lower. There are some stats that I can't remember off the top of my head around that. And then I think it's certainly changing. I think it would be interesting to know, but having lectured at IOM pretty much annually, I would say there's kind of been an increase in the number of men in each cohort. So it's definitely shifting there. But apart from that, I don't think I really know, because there are a lot of, if you think of like the fitness industry, I think it's probably that a lot of males go into kind of more the personal training, at least initially, from a health space perspective.
It might be that, you know, obviously as a personal trainer, you do cover some nutrition. I know that some people who are trainers kind of say, you know, even say kind of like, that don't exactly, actually, I met somebody once who said, I'm a nutritional therapist. And I just kind of got this. I said to them, what a real one, you know, because it didn't feel like they'd done the training. So people in effect, you know, obviously there's some basics, which we all know, you know, like don't eat shit food, you know, excuse my French, you know, we all sort of know that. So it's actually about the detail of that in a maybe a personal training course where people think, oh, well, I've got the basics in, I probably don't need to look at this further.
And, you know, it's kind of, you're being taught the sort of government guideline sort of recommendations ultimately. So, yeah, that's how basic it is.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Well, so here you are. You mentioned you're a lecturer at ION. Obviously, I am an ION girl. Well, not obviously, but I am. And, of course, Kate Neal was my principal at the time, because that was 25 years ago that I was at ION. And so she went obviously to found her own college, which is marvelous as well, and very good for sort of doing kind of add-on training, not least. And she's so thorough, Kate, I think, you know, really. Yeah. Although, you know, I'm very loyal to both, you know, all, as I have to say. But yeah, so basically, what was I going to say? Something was coming to my mind and it slipped right out. Oh, yeah. So tell me about Health Path then. So how you're involved with them, or, you know, because what do you do for them?
Yeah. So I am a co-founder for Health Path and Health Path Pro. And Health Path Pro is a practitioner platform, ultimately. So it's an opportunity. I think our dream is ultimately for it to become a one-stop shop where nutritional therapists have the capacity to manage each element of their clinical practice. So at the click of a button at the moment, you can very simply create your supplement protocols. You can order your functional testing through the platform. There are food plans that are available. So there are things like a 14-day low FODMAP diet, Mediterranean diet, paleo diet. And we just understand, because of our backgrounds, and you know, and everyone listening knows, that a 1-hour consult is 5 hours work, because there's so much that goes on behind the scene. And I think
that's such a good point, because it's so difficult then for us. You know, I remember in the early days, as you so rightly say, you know, when, I mean, obviously with practice, you do get the timings better, but there's still, you know, you have to build up your handouts. You have to, it's such a lot of work. And wouldn't it be marvelous to have a resource?
Yeah, I think so. You know, and that's our dream, to kind of streamline that admin part of things, because I certainly know it took me a while to even start creating like master handouts. So I was finding I was just replicating the same sort of messages, and I'm a slow learner. So it took me a while to think that maybe I should just create some sort of master files. But if we can automate as much,
you know, I did exactly the same thing, which is every time, you know what I mean? That's sort of like, why didn't you just do a copy and paste? But no, you'd sort of find yourself typing it out again like an idiot, you know, basically.
I did that for quite
a while. And then it's like, and sometimes it is the busyness, you know, do you know what I mean? Which is, you get busy, even if you're not particularly busy as a practitioner, you're busy with other stuff. And then you suddenly have a client in front of you and you don't know where you file things accurately. Well, I'm sure you're a lot more efficient than me, but you've put them all in. You think you've put them in a file and actually you haven't. then you spend half an hour looking for the flipping thing, and you could have just copied and pasted. You know, you could have just retyped it out the time you spent looking for the template that you. Oh, anyway, yes, it all's bringing back horrible memories. So yeah, so wouldn't it be marvelous if, at a click of the button, you were able to just go.
And you know, some of it really is like that. So for the food plans, for supplements, you can search for the supplement like you would on a dispensary, and you click recommend. Some of the supplements were auto-populated in regards to the doses. So obviously it's the generic dose that you can then just personalize when that's not appropriate. So, you know, I am a creature of habit. So when I first started using it, I was hesitant because it was new. And when something's new, it can sometimes take a little bit of time, obviously, to get familiar. But it is so simple that actually I'm not sure I could ever be without something like that now. I know that sounds terribly salesy, but it's true.
Well, no, I mean, you know, I think the thing is in England, or Britain or wherever we are, we're all a bit hesitant usually if somebody sounds like they're being salesy, but I don't think that sounds salesy at all, actually. I just think it's, you know, if something is good, you know, you want people to have it, you know, that's it. So, you know, before we go, we're going to talk a little bit about gut health today generally, aren't we? But how can, just so we've got it now, how can people go and, I mean, sorry, do you offer people kind of a go with it so that they can get familiar or training? Yeah, we'll talk about this at the end as well, but just so they've got it now.
Yeah, it's a free platform at the moment. So you can go to healthpathpro.com. You can register, log in, play around with it. You can book a call with my colleague Matt at matt@healthpath.com. And he will give you a demo and show you all the different features that are there. We also have over 100 different resources for practitioners as well as customers. So there are CPD accredited webinars, dozens of them on all sorts of different things, ranging from gut health to histamine intolerance to mold illness and mycotoxins to fibromyalgia. And there are resources for customers or clients. So from this perspective, if you have a client and let's just say one of their most prominent symptoms is bloating, you can, at a click of a button, give them a little 15-minute presentation around, you know, the underlying causes of bloating and some of the things that we might need to consider as a way to improve it. So again, we're trying to build up this repertoire of resources as well, aimed at both practitioners, but also that their clients can then use as kind of a bit of an educational piece to their support process.
So I don't misunderstand. You said that's free, or do they have to pay
It is free. You know? So you can go and you can access all of that for free at the moment. So we want as many practitioners to use it, partly because we want as much feedback as possible, because we're in that kind of really privileged position of being able to then to create stuff. So if there's something that a practitioner really needs or wants, they can let us know. And obviously we might not be able to do it in the next day or week, but we'll add it to the list of things that we are building. So there are constantly new features being added based on our feedback.
So, you know, regarding our conversation about sales, in effect, it's free. So it's not really sales, it's free. So there's no catch, folks, it's just free. So what is your aspirations for it though? Because presumably it won't be free forever.
Yeah, I'm not involved actually in the business side of things. So I'm sure the main man, Richard, has sort of a plan there.
But for now, it's don't worry about it.
I think, you know, there are some dreams that I have in regard to delivering specific online sort of courses, and also obviously the mentoring side of things, which will be a feature that at some point comes along as well, where we can do a little bit more kind of in-depth one-to-one, but also group mentoring for nutritional therapists in the UK as well. So that's kind of one of the things that I will be heavily involved in, obviously.
Well, that would be brilliant. And we'll have you back when you're ready for that stage, because, you know, our passion here at the network, the Nutrition Network, is to just give valuable information to our people and to put you in touch with them so that you're able to transmit that valuable, you know, information to them. And I know sort of like, actually, do you know, the statistics I quote at the beginning of when you log onto the network say something like 97% of all nutritional therapists fail after the first, I think, 2 years. That was relevant actually 10 years ago. I'm not sure the stats should really update that. But do you have any kind of feeling of how still quite difficult it is to be a nutritional therapist and how they people do need help to be successful?
I think so. I mean, it is a hard industry for various reasons. One, most of us are obviously self-employed for starters. So unless you have some degree of business knowledge, that's, you know, the first barrier that I think a lot of people have once they've graduated. And I know things are slightly different. There's a little bit more business training in, like, for example, IOM these days compared to even probably 5-6 years ago. But it's also quite a saturated industry, I think. You know, there are an awful lot of nutritional therapists. However, there's an awful lot, there's an awfully big demand because the state of our health at a population level is unfortunately just so kind of tragic. So
I love that.
I think there's that real positive element to it. And obviously the industry is just booming, as we all know. So there are so many new different opportunities for nutritional therapists that there weren't like when I graduated, in regards to, you know, even part-time employment or full-time employment with shops, supplement companies, testing laboratories, these sorts of things. Like, there are more employable positions, which if you want that sort of safety and security, are obviously much more prominent these days.
Well, it definitely helps, I think, if you have even if it's part-time employment. I mean, you know, whilst you get your practice legs, absolutely, you know, up and going, because otherwise, if you're doing it from zero, it is quite difficult to stay in the industry in effect. So you do need all the tricks and tools you can have to stay successful, stay focused. It's so easy to get really defocused. I was lucky because very early on I had a big contract with a food company, actually.
Okay.
So if it hadn't been for them, I don't know if I would have survived, you know. Mm-hmm. So yes, anyway, tell us about, so they can get in touch. We'll go through the details at Health Path Pro. Sorry.
Yeah, that's it. That's all right.
Health Path Pro. It's kind of like difficult if you don't have your teeth in. and they can find that easily, can they?
Yeah, healthpathpro.com. So you can use the URL or just Google it. It will be the first one up there.
Cool. That sounds so positive. And as I say, do come back and tell us when you've got more of the mentoring programs up. I think that really does sound exciting. Sure. Yeah, no, definitely. Yeah.
The only other thing just that I mentioned, because it excites me, which is one of our goals is to connect nutritional therapists with like inquiries as well. So we're hoping to eventually have a database within the platform of nutritional therapists in the UK that sort of the general public will be able to, so they can find a local practitioner, essentially. So we're hoping to kind of almost also become a sort of a middleman in regards to helping nutritional therapists actually build their...
Yeah, to get some business in, which is always really helpful, actually. I remember Patrick had a kind of platform for that when I was practicing all those years ago, you know.
Brilliant.
And it was really helpful because it did give you a few leads a month. You know, you still have to do your own stuff, obviously, but just to have a basis of somebody doing the hard work for you is incredibly important as well. Yeah. So before we tuned in today, we were talking a little bit about kind of, you know, we're talking in the COVID era, just after, hopefully, fingers crossed. So 2022, and about people. You were saying that people are kind of nervous about their health or their gut health. What were you saying? Sorry. interesting, Alex.
That we have seen a real increase in just health anxiety, to keep it kind of generalized. So, you know, we know in the research with IBS, for example, that there is this element of kind of hypervigilance, that people are just very vigilant around their symptoms. And this kind of brings in sort of visceral hypersensitivity in the gut brain axis from kind of a physiological perspective, but just kind of behaviorally.
Do you mean that basically you know, it's interesting. It's very interesting because also, as you may know, I mean, I don't know if you tuned into any of these interviews, I am also doing an MA in anthropology of food. It's taking me a lot longer than I thought, wow. Only because I put it on pause this year because of the pandemic. But anyway, part of that was to do medical anthropology, which is really interesting. And it's really around culture. But do you think the sort of very sort of diagnosis of IBS brings up some of the anxiety in its own right? Because people, you know, it's useful to have a diagnosis. But as you pointed out in the beginning, you know, actually that wasn't really very helpful, because actually knowing you've got IBS is one thing, but knowing how to deal with it is another, and then there's lots of conflicting information out there.
Exactly. So I think it's just it's sort of a that not necessarily toxic soup, but it is a soup of all of these different variables of I've been given a diagnosis that doesn't really mean much. There's, as you say, just so much contradictory information out there. There's a number of underlying imbalances that can contribute to the diagnosis. And they're because people have such access to information these days that even 10 years ago we didn't, it leaves people, I think, confused ultimately. And I think, you know, sometimes us practitioners are confused because of the same factors, especially the kind of contradictory information. But it's interesting because, you know, I've worked with clients, I've done quite a lot in chronic fatigue syndrome, and the same sort of thing from my perspective, in the sense that I don't think it's a particularly helpful diagnoses, but some people actually feel a sense of relief that they've just got the label, if or whatever you want.
Yeah. So it's the same in this medical anthropology, because you're looking at the fact that it can be very helpful. I did a course in it's issues in culture, mind, and it's psychiatry, looking at basically the DSM, which is a manual of diagnoses in a manual, and it's been added to, and it's like now about this fat, and so of course once you get a diagnosis of, I mean, there's even post pandemic anxiety syndrome, you know, just so there's all these different labels, which kind of is great in one way because you can go and get help. But as we pointed out, here we are in this place where there's a waiting list on the NHS of, I think I saw 9 million. There's a kind of some kind of leaked document to say it's 9 million, and you can't get in to see your doctor, and they're not interested because they can't solve it unless it's something serious, which of course you should always go to your doctor for. But, you know, what do they do, these people? So no wonder they're anxious. There's nothing they can do about it, no?
Yeah, I think that's a big part of it ultimately. But then I also think, you know, there's a conversation that I think we had around the safety we feel in knowledge, but the fact that we also at the same time need to try and feel more safe in the unknown. You know, there's definitely a direct relationship I see in people between their needs for things to be black and white and their anxiety levels. And right. if we're feeling unsafe and if we're anxious, we're clinging on to black and white because it gives us a sense of safety and security that, okay, this is what I need to do, or this is what I have, this is what's wrong with me. So it's completely understandable that, you know, we all, in our own way, we all do this ultimately. Mm. We're all looking for security and safety. It's a human need. It's just how that plays out ultimately, I think.
Well, presumably in this sort of pandemic period, that's kind of gone to hell in a handcart, because people have had sort of a load of kind of stuff flung at them for a couple of years, which they have not been in control of at all, whether it's at a higher level, like governmental level, or the personal level, like with jobs and all this sort of thing. So that, do you think it's like the gut issues are like an idiom of distress, that, you know, meaning that it's not really a rise in gut issues, which may have already always been there, but a rise in the anxiety levels, which are looking around for things to solve? Or do you think really there's actually a real increase in gut problems? Do you see what I mean? Is it the anxiety around it?
Yeah.
At something else, which is being translated into this, or is it actually really the gut has really gone up this morning?
I think, you know, I do think it will be both. You could think over the last 2 years that as a population, we've been far more sedentary, we've been more isolated. There's been more stress and anxiety day to day for many of us just because.
And more, maybe more treating, because I know there's a whole lot of people who said, right, this is the time. I have a really dear friend called Michelle, and she really got her act together, you know. And she's I don't know how many pounds or stones she lost, you know, she looks absolutely amazing. So she really got her act together.
Yeah.
And then other people have gone the other,
exactly,
the other way.
Yeah, it seems to be one of the extremes, doesn't it? But, you know, I think it's definitely, if you think, again, it's going to be very different for different people, but there are certainly people who have been sat watching Netflix, eating takeaways for 2 years with the lockdowns and things. And for some people, that's really all they've had access to during lockdown. So there's all sorts of considerations that come into this dependent on everything from our kind of socioeconomic status to our geographical location, our preferences, our level of control. There's a really interesting validated questionnaire, which is all about our locus of control. You know, basically, how strongly do we believe we're in control of our health? And that, for me, again, is a really interesting concept. I think as a nutritional therapist supporting our client, we probably get a sense of that just through a conversation with them.
So does that really, so for presumably, if you don't feel like you have control of your health, I mean, most of us as nutritional therapists really feel that we have quite a lot of control over our health, because we think we can solve most things through diet. I mean, that's how we think, you know. So we're probably going to have quite a high level of kind of confidence in solving health problems. Is that right? And if you don't have that, maybe if you start from a poor basis of cancer or wherever you're at, you have the change that you need to make is much more difficult to make, because you don't have the confidence in the solution.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, it will influence the relationship between client and practitioner. So, you know, it's partly come out of how conventional medicine was established, the idea of the doctor fixing the patient and the doctor knowing what's wrong and having that power and information and education. And we've all probably experienced clients where they come to us with this expectation that we're going to fix them. And that can play out as, I'm going to do this test, I'm going to take this supplement protocol and this specific diet, and then I'll be well. So it's kind of taking that same mentality, but just from a sort of a complementary sort of approach. Whereas others, we have a conversation with the clients, they sort of are empowered, and they don't necessarily see you as the fixer, but they see you as a bit of a guide and to show the directions and the options that are available to them. So they understand, oh, okay, this is the path that I need to go down. I'm going to go down that path and I'll speak to you in 2-3 months time, kind of thing.
And is that quite a rare animal, or is that, you know, I mean, could you sort of guess at a split of that kind of in?
I mean, I would say in my experience and speaking with colleagues about this, it comes partly back to how are you attracting your clients. So I know that a client that comes to me who's been following me on Instagram or something like that, they have an expectation of my views on health. They have a rough understanding of what it's going to look like, who I am, my ethos. It aligns with theirs, and that relationship is such an easier, smoother one compared to someone who comes to me because they've stumbled across my website, has sent me an email, and we have a consult, and they have no idea about my ethos, and it's a very different relationship and trajectory.
Well, exactly that. I mean, I used to, when I was practicing, make sure I always spoke to them, because, you know, although that takes 20 minutes of your time, it was saved an awful lot of headaches later on. Yeah. Because I remember actually getting sent somebody from another practitioner who was a psychiatrist or something. So the client already arrived, I mean, in not a good mental condition, and was really, really ready to blame me for absolutely everything. If I had spoken to that person, I would have been able to really easily iron those problems out, you know.
Yeah.
You know, definitely. So so it's worth the investment. Either do you say that they get to know you through social,
absolutely,
or a phone call.
Discovery calls, I think, are really important, and I'm I'm kind of going back into clinical practice after almost being out for kind of 6 months or so. But I've actually also been thinking about, I think it's also potentially fair to charge for that discovery call. I don't even think it needs to be free. It could be a, you know, let's say a £25 half hour consult, which is refunded if they start working with you.
Yeah, it's a nice idea.
You're likely imparting a lot of knowledge, wisdom, information, experience in that half hour that is worth the other charge, therefore.
Yeah, I mean, I've got a thing, actually, not for that, but I've got a sort of once hub, you know, thing, which would be nice for that, your health path kind of idea somewhere, is to have, you know, I've, this once hub thing is just like a link that links people into your diary. And it would be good if somehow on that form, if there's kind of like, you know, I don't know, this is chargeable. Because what I found was at the time was that the practitioner was chasing these flipping clients and they just let their phone run, go to voicemail, which was so frustrating. So you're not only, well, you don't even know if they're not going to work with you or not, but also they disappeared, so you couldn't get hold of them. So it's left you chasing them. So that's a really good idea, actually. Top tip, everybody. Yeah, sort of just have that refundable against a booked appointment, and actually much more likely, because then you've got the serious people who are at least serious in using your time and all the rest of it.
Absolutely. No,
really good idea. So we are finally going to talk a little bit about gut health. So, yeah, so you were saying that we've got this sort of health anxiety around, especially around gut health. So what does that look like and how can we deal with it?
The health anxiety or?
Yeah, you were saying about gut, especially about around gut health.
I think from our experience, it's around gut health just because we do so much gut testing. But I think your health anxiety is just like general.
Just out there. Okay.
Yeah.
But so gut health, talk us through that.
Yeah, so I guess maybe a nice place to start is just obviously first appreciating that I think when we talk about gut health, we now are talking about everything from mouth to anus. You know, back in the day, we'd talk about gut health and it was largely the large intestine, maybe a little bit about the stomach as well with H. pylori. But obviously the last decade or so, SIBO has become this huge beast in its own right as well. But there's really interesting research on kind of the stomach and the stomach microbiome. It isn't a sterile environment and it does influence various parameters of health. And we're also seeing obviously that the oral microbiome is becoming a really important topic, and that can be intimately connected with SIBO. So when we're looking at our SIBO breath tests, are we actually only looking at gases that are being produced in the small or large intestine, or are we actually looking at gases that are being produced in the mouth, the esophagus, the stomach? And actually some research suggests elsewhere in the body as well, including the lung microbiome, potentially the vaginal microbiome, potentially gases being emitted from the poo if someone is severely constipated. So there's some really interesting stuff coming out, which makes SIBO interpretation a little bit more tricky and not necessarily as simple as something like the North American consensus that a lot of us use when we're kind of interpreting our test results. So
when you're breathing, presumably you're, you know, as in a breath test, the lung microbiome is going to play a part in the result.
Yeah, that's what people have theorized, at least. And, you know, there's a paper that talks about methane hotspots in the body. And, you know, we have Methanobrevibacter auralis, a methane producing organism in the mouth that can overgrow. We have methanogens in the sinus cavity. They're not just potentially in the small intestine and almost always in the large intestine. So if you have someone who does a SIBO breath test and their methane levels are high, including the baseline sample, the question becomes, well, why is your baseline sample elevated if you did the pre-test protocol correctly, where you fasted for 12 hours and did the restrictive diet for 12 hours? And in one paper, they were looking at gas production in the stomach in a fasted state. And there was a subgroup of, I think, about 18% of people who were actually producing methane gas in a fasted state from the stomach. So again, there's kind of, it's not as simple as your kind of emptying the small intestine, taking your lactulose, glucose or fructose, and then seeing what happens within the small intestine. It's a much more holistic interpretation that I think we need to consider. And then there's also a bit of research indicating that methane might actually be produced from our own cells in certain states, such as a hypoxic state. So what really interests me at the moment is, are these growing arguments people are delivering that a lot of these, if we stick with SIBO for now, a lot of these results are adaptive mechanisms. So if someone's producing excessive levels of methane or hydrogen sulfide, is that an adaptive response? Has the microbiome deliberately allowed a bloom of methanogens or sulfate reducing bacteria? Because actually the body needs something from that change in the ecosystem. So
you mean we could be tinkering with stuff that actually might have a sort of, well, it might be there for a reason.
It might be there for a reason. It's the exact same thing as hypocortisolemia in adrenal testing. You know, the theory being that if someone's got low cortisol in an adrenal test, is that an adaptive response? Cortisol is an immunomodulatory anti-inflammatory hormone. We often see it low in things like chronic fatigue syndrome. But if the body is struggling to deal with something like a chronic infection, would it make sense that actually it would lower free cortisol as a way to free up the immune system to actually have a greater capacity to deal with an infection that it's struggling to deal with?
Yeah. So in other words, it's sort of that, it's sort of laying the breadcrumbs so that you sort of, in other words, it's the same, isn't it? So interesting about nutritional therapy generally, because it's kind of like, I always used to ask myself the question, so what does that mean? And so what does that mean?
Yeah.
So what does that mean? Because it's not just, you know, looking at the result itself. Do you know what I mean? And going, you know, okay, low methane. Brilliant. Let's pump you full of methane.
Exactly.
You know, or whatever it is. And yes, certainly with cortisol, I think that's a really good point. But it's a good question to ask, isn't it? So what does that mean?
Yeah, exactly. And I think, you know, I do think the body has far more intelligence and wisdom than we give it credit for. So again, you know, I think most things are a deliberate mechanism. So as you say, then you ask the question, well, why would the body actually choose to do this? And that would allow you to get back to the root cause, which I think an increasing number of people are also having a bit of a tough time accepting, myself included, because I've seen how it creates so much friction in clients when they think there's this one thing causing their symptoms. And it can happen, obviously, but health and dis-ease, I think, are both accumulative. And we know that they are. You know, an example being adverse childhood events being strongly correlated with disease 30 years later when we're adults. You know, how much wear and tear has there been on our physiology as a result of the stresses and the lifestyle that we have led, and the stresses, traumas that we've experienced, especially in our early years, but also at any time. So when you take that step back, you know, I like Dr. Tom O'Brien's concept of the 30,000 foot view. Again, you know, we might want to go down these rabbit holes and have a really good understanding of methane or hydrogen sulfide, but then you've got to step back. And you've got to think, okay, well, let's now focus back on the person, their story, what's going on in their life. And actually, are they doing the foundational work that they need to be doing before we consider, you know, tweaking these things that are kind of often going to be the last 10, 15, 20% of their health journey. But fundamentally, are they breathing well? Are they doing appropriate levels of physical activity and all the things that we preach about day in, day out?
Yeah, that's really interesting. It's the sort of how people, again, the clients or whatever we're calling them, is probably conditioned by conventional medicine to look at the diagnosis rather than the person. Whereas with us, it's obviously the person rather than the diagnosis. So again, it's that conditioning of the condition, the conventional health system to say, right, well, hang on a minute, it's low cortisol, it's been diagnosed with, you know, this test. Now, what are you going to do about it? You know, and actually that education to say what's actually, you know, a lot of it's going to be to do with you, you know, rather than me being Merlin the magician making it all happen for you.
Absolutely. And again, it kind of goes back alongside that thinking is we've been in this era, I think, of pathologizing everything. You know, I'm doing a psychedelic practitioner training program at the moment. I'm in a small pods, and three of the people are psychotherapists, and it's really interesting to hear them talk about how they feel there's a lot of kind of pathologizing of mental health. You know, you have this condition.
Yeah.
At what point do you hit the criteria that mean that you are XYZ? And I think
that is what I was talking about earlier with the medical anthropology, where you're looking at culture actually, in effect, saying, okay, the diagnosis is helpful for some people, but it can also mean that you're then pathologizing them for them to take drugs. There's a great book actually called Crazy Like Us, which, you know, which is a great book. It's really readable. It's not an anthropology book, which are totally unreadable, by the way. But he's called, what's he called? I've got it over there. I'll get it for you if you're interested. But it's about looking at how the Japanese, for example, didn't have a word for depression. They just didn't have it in their language. Mm. And how the drug companies created a word for it, and therefore a diagnosis, and therefore people then started to have depression. And actually, again, it happens with the menopause in Japan. Japan, the women do not experience menopause, and it's really difficult for people because, of course, women experience menopause, you know, obviously. But actually, if you don't label it, you can attribute the symptoms to something else. Like they just say it was just getting old. They don't attribute it. And also the language they use around it as well. It's called something like, evolving into a different energy. It's or something like that, which just isn't the same thing as menopause, which is a medical term, you know. So anyway, I'm banging on about anthropology as usual. But
but it's an important point. Because, you know, yes, it, as you say, it can be helpful, but it can also... it can put people in a kind of a prison of I am this diagnosis and I am that. And it's like, well, actually, as you've been saying there, you know, let's kind of unpick this a little bit. I did a podcast recently with Marek Doyle, and we kind of were talking about adrenal fatigue. And, you know, many people will be familiar. There was a paper that came out maybe 3 years ago. Some endocrinologists wrote a paper saying adrenal fatigue does not exist. And it's like, it's just words. You know, adrenal fatigue is a term. It's not a specific entity.
Yeah, and what they miss out is the somatic experience of actually experiencing the condition, if you see what I mean, meaning it's actually what the person is experiencing, not, by the way, it doesn't exist because I've written it here that it doesn't.
And also they're citing studies, lots of studies where, you know, these individuals do have hypocortisolemia. So again, it's like, well, no, we do know that there is this physiological state where people have lower than normal levels of free cortisol. It's not that you have Addison's or Cushing's or you're normal. Everything is a spectrum. But again, to have the DSM and things, it's like, okay, well, you get to this point and then suddenly you're going to get this diagnosis.
It's really interesting.
It's kind of a bit destabilizing, I think.
Yeah, exactly. That which is, you know, doing this course as I did at SOAS in, it's called Studies in Issues in Mind, Culture and Psychiatry. And it's destabilizing because you think, no, hang on a minute, the menopause does exist. You know, I can tell you it does exist. And it feels like almost like, hang on, it's a mind blowing up. It's all like a PTSD is the same. It's like PTSD. We have it as a diagnosis. Obviously, you might know people with PTSD. So you're thinking, are you sort of dismissing these people by saying, not it doesn't exist, but it's just basically a label that somebody's come up with. So it's just so interesting. It's words. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And then, of course, you have to get your symptoms to match what the DSM has said. Otherwise, you don't have PTSD. Mm. And therefore, you don't get the help you want because you don't have the diagnosis. But you might have actually what is kind of war trauma or whatever, some kind of trauma that doesn't match the definition. So therefore, sorry, you don't have it.
Yeah.
I've gone off on anthropology again. Sorry. Anyway. Yeah. So I interrupted.
Yeah,
we're just talking
about green on cortisol is another example, didn't we? But I guess, you know, that's kind of it touches on the complexity of something that at first can feel quite simple. We know SIBO, the rise of 20 in hydrogen, you're positive, 10 at any point for methane, you're positive. And it's like, well, again, you've got these criteria, but we've got to also just think about the clients and what are they experiencing and what's their story and their narrative ultimately.
Yeah, so you could sort of just latch on to say, you know, it, and also think that you obviously have to select which tests you go for, because obviously it'd be too expensive to do everything. Mm-hmm. So you might just be testing something that isn't the most relevant thing.
Yeah. Absolutely. I think that's such a good point. And again, something that sometimes when we're looking for certainty, we can forget, because we're going to latch on to that one test that we have. And I was thinking about this even about mycotoxins testing the other day, you know, the idea that if you do a mycotoxin test, it comes back positive. You know, from a symptomatic perspective, do you need to get that person with a negative mycotoxin test? And the answer is probably no. You know, you could probably get significant improvement, but I was speaking with a client yesterday whose repeat test is three of the mycotoxins that were very high are now negative, but one of them is still technically positive, but he's feeling really great. It's like, well, do we need to worry about that? You know, it could have more of a long-term impact in 20, 30 years if you do still have a burden of this toxin, but we certainly don't have to go in with any comprehensive, thorough program and think, oh my God, you've still got this mycotoxin because you're feeling so good. So again, that context of we all have stuff in us that, you know, you could argue is problematic. But then we also have the research showing us, like in brain autopsies, that you can have someone who's got significant pathology, who's cognitively very independent and functioning, and someone with less pathology who's actually manifesting Alzheimer's disease. So there's not even a correlation between the amount of damage or whatever you want to call it and the phenotypic expression of it, which again, I kind of think is a bit mind-blowing.
Yeah, that is a bit mind-blowing in one sense. As I say, I think we're so conditioned to look for cause and result of stuff, aren't we? Sort of like, and actually, I'm thinking of my own dear mum, who is like 84 years young, cracking on. But I mean, she definitely has a little, I mean, you know, she likes a gin and tonic, let's put it that way. I mean, not too many, but she does like a gin and tonic. I mean, you know, if it was conventionally, you know, we're like, knock off that, otherwise you're going to destroy your brain. She's just like, you know what, I'm 84, it's kept me going. So, but you know, it's that, isn't it? Which is, if somebody, to somebody else, that maybe that's the thing that throws them over the cliff.
Yeah, exactly. You know, there's so much that goes into it. And this is why I think we have a problem even in the kind of holistic functional medicine, nutritional therapy space, which is we still are very guilty of reductionism.
Yeah.
You know, you can't talk about sleep and discuss its correlation with stuff without thinking about everything else. So it makes it so hard to truly understand what are the biggest drivers ultimately.
Absolutely. You know, we've all had patients, well, I used to call them patients in the old days, clients who, you know, the big problem for them was a spiritual problem, which of course you'd be like, you know, you can't say that. It's like, you know, it's really the biggest problem. You know, you need to go away and find some meaning in your life and purpose. That's the big problem there. Not really that you've got some kind of methane issue. Mm. It's interesting because I think we are guilty of trying to play with the big boys as we see it, you know, like the testing, the functional medicine and all the rest of it. But sometimes it's so much more intuitive, actually, and kind of a bit more fuzzy than we'd probably like to admit.
Yeah, I think so. And I think, you know, I've been reflecting on this quite a lot recently as well, which is even as a nutritional therapist, you know, our title is a therapist, and therefore I think we also have to be really mindful of what we're bringing into the consultation, our beliefs around health, our beliefs with money. You know, when it comes to testing, it's really interesting. I've had people come and sort of shadow me sort of a few years ago and having conversations afterwards about how I would introduce the kind of testing, and oh, isn't a stool test really expensive? I'm sorry, but I think it might be still a good idea to do, but you're kind of setting them up for for seeing it that way.
Yeah. And you're sort of vaguely looking at their shoes and thinking, I wonder if they can afford this. Those shoes look like they need replacing. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And all these complex things, because you have to be really ethical as a nutritional therapist, in the sense that obviously there's commission that we can earn from testing, and when is it kind of over testing? When can you do a lot of good by just improving the diet at not even a complex level, you know, just like, because the diet is so rubbish, probably improving it would probably have a big impact before you get into the testing. But of course, having to earn a living and letting that cloud what decisions you make. I mean, it's probably impossible. I mean, you have to be very authentic and ethical, but, you know, where is that line, you know? Mm-hmm.
I had a mentor at the very beginning of my business, and I always remember him saying that, you know, the sort of, unfortunately, in some ways, the more financially secure you are, the better the therapist you are, because you're not kind of worried about, oh my God, but I've got to pay my bill at the end of the month. Shall I recommend this test? And I'm not saying that anyone's consciously necessarily doing that, but underneath, it's probably influencing our decision making. So that really kind of stuck with me. As kind of, you know, if you can be really sort of secure there, it probably does influence some of that decision making. And I find myself these days often talking clients out of testing, but they still want to go and do it anyway. Yeah. So,
well, there's a certain amount of sort of that doubting Thomas thing. I remember what, you know, for me being in practice, I mean, I definitely used to have kind of, you know, two or three tests that I used to recommend. I mean, like, I used to, you know, hair mineral analysis, which is very reasonable, and it's sort of an introduction to testing, you know, a sort of rolling introduction to testing, if you know what I mean, because it's quite accessible. You get some information and people can start to act on that. Then adrenal tests of some description or another, and then gut tests, which of course, as a nutritional therapist, probably that is our core, really, isn't it?
I mean, it is a good point. So to kind of counter myself, when I've had either someone who's just highly invested in the health or someone who's kind of wealthy, I have to say, when I've done a stool test, a comprehensive blood chemistry test, and an organic acid test, because they layer on each other so well, you get a really confident understanding of this is what's going on, and therefore this is what we need to do.
Yeah, the organic acid test, I forgot about that. It's really good. That's really useful, I think.
Yeah. I do think it's kind of like you either sort of invest up front in a lot, or you don't do much at all. I think there's a middle ground where you said earlier, is if you just have one test result, it's, you know, you're looking at not much within the grand scheme of the different systems in the body. And therefore, are you blinded to the fact that actually could have this massive problem elsewhere, which is what you need to be doing?
Yes, I mean, that's where also our skill as clinicians come in, you know, which is asking the questions, because you can, you know, I remember one person sort of just about to leave the door. They didn't even put it on their form. And it's sort of like, you know, you just, any other things? Oh, yeah, I did have the breast cancer. You're like, sorry? You know, and they're literally just about to, I mean, it was obviously a fault of mine for not quizzing them enough, but, you know, it's that sort of thing where they hadn't even thought to mention it. Mm. And you're like, ah, okay, well, that might, it's going to change my thinking a little bit on this, you know. So that the skill of the clinician is still really important in getting that context. So when it comes to gut health, because we're back to that, back to gut health. We don't have to be slaves to what we said we'd talk about. We could talk about anything. We talk about anthropology and all these philosophical things. But yeah, so what would you sort of consider some of the key, you know, just quick wins, gut health, and what we should be looking out for?
So what we should be looking out for, I guess, is you've got sort of the north to south, the gut to brain concept. So I guess in one way is, if we were just to work our way down, you've got the idea of, well, are our clients actually chewing their food? Are they eating in a relaxed environment? Are they in that kind of more parasympathetic state? So they've got that hydrochloric acid, pancreatic juice production, good motility, and all those sorts of things. But then you're also thinking about, obviously, the oral microbiome, what's going on in the stomach from either an acidity or an H. pylori perspective primarily for us, really. And then what's going on in the small and large intestine. So, I mean, some of the things that we see the most of, I would say, are essentially what I refer to as bacterial deficiencies. So, you know, just very low levels, lower diversity than what is optimal. So keystone species like Akkermansia and Faecalibacterium and some of those other butyrate producers, we see low almost all the time. You know, it's a really common theme that we see within the customers or clients that are doing testing with us.
So how do you know what is normal then?
Well, labs...
Maybe that is normal.
Yeah. Labs will obviously have... It's a good question, though, because labs obviously have their cohorts that they are accessing. So they've taken 1,000, 2,000, 3,000, 4,000 healthy people, and they've looked for those kind of typical reference ranges. And I do think it's important to appreciate that, you know, that's not therefore the kind of the gold standard. And as you say, you could have some minor deviations and that would be normal. So when we look at store results, I certainly recommend we're looking at themes and trends. We're not necessarily looking at individual markers. The exception might be keystone species like Akkermansia, because we've got the research showing that that one organism can influence human health in X, Y, Z ways. So there are some organisms that are either so prominent in the gut, because Akkermansia can make up, let's say on average, 10% of the microbiome. So it's a big one within the community. And the metabolites that some of these keystone species are producing, we know have systemic health properties or benefits as well. And this is where I think the microbiome research is going as well. You know, it's one thing to say you've got this amount of this organism. It's another thing to say you've got this amount of the organism and this is what it's doing or producing. Because that's ultimately what matters. It's the metabolites they're producing that has a big impact. So I think when we go into that kind of metabolomics sort of area of the research, and we can say, okay, well, you are producing these compounds or these genes are being expressed within these organisms, I think it's going to become a lot more clinically viable as the next few years progress. So it is super exciting, I think, for the microbiome research.
So, you know, since most people are deficient in these keystone cultures, should everybody just supplement, or how would you?
Yeah, so it's a very common question that we get, and especially, you know, many people would have seen, I think it was last week, that there was a new product in the UK, Akkermansia, in a probiotic, in the first of its kind. And obviously there are some people who will think that if you're low in this, well, let's just give you some. And that's obviously kind of your green pharmacy sort of principle. It's not that that's necessarily bad if it's understood that that's a very short-term principle, but we obviously want to go with the idea that we want you to nourish and nurture what you've got. And if we appreciate, you know, the idea that the UK have the fiber gap, and as a population, we're lacking polyphenols in our diets, we're sedentary, etc. We've got so many things that we can do from a lifestyle perspective that is going to support both the amount of these organisms, but also their kind of metabolic capacity. So exercise, we know that the way I try and describe this is the fitter we are as the host, the fitter our bacteria are, meaning they're producing greater quantities of butyrate, for example. So it takes us back to this real crux of the foundations are very easy, I think, to underappreciate or ignore. And I think, I do think a lot of us as practitioners go on our own journey here, you know, where we want to do the testing and the fancy stuff. And sometimes even us are forgetting that actually the principles are where we need to start. And I've been guilty of it, I think, with certain clients over the years. And I'm certainly coming more and more back to the fact that nature is arguably our best healer. And I don't think there's much of an argument against that. When you look at some of the research around light, our light environment, I've been reading about Alan recently, artificial light at night, and the impact that's having. So we all know that blue light reduces melatonin, but it's much more than that ultimately. So
somebody was telling me that actually, which makes sense. I mean, I just literally fell into fell into this yesterday, I think, saying that the light obviously is a frequency. I'm probably out of my depth here already, but so it's actually impacting your skin all over, including your little toe. So it's not really about the light you get through your eyes. Of course, that's what we obviously think about.
No, absolutely affects the skin. So we have research, both in animal and human studies, showing us that infrared light influences the microbiome. So in animal studies, shining an infrared light device in the tummy of a mouse improves microbiome diversity. It's been shown to increase keystone species like Akkermansia in humans. So we've evolved over millennia to be outside under the sun most of the day. We are just massively what they define as, or describe as, malilluminated. It's the last 200 years or so that this artificial light has become just like what it is today. And it, when you start thinking about it from that perspective, you can't help but think, oh my God, like, we just don't know what this is doing to our health, really. So I'm a huge advocate these days for things like your blue light blocking glasses, the app Flux that you can get on your laptop, and really trying to do the best you can to modulate that light environment, because it's just as important, if not more important, than your nutrition environment.
So not that we're promoting blue blocker glasses by any particular company here, guys, but which ones do you use? Do you use the Swanix or do you use the blue blockers?
I've just come across, what are they called? I think it's just called Blue Light Blocking. They're a UK company. Their glasses block the full spectrum of blue light that has been evidenced to reduce melatonin. And they've got, I don't have them with me, but they've got one pair, which I've just bought, which I used to have Swanwits or Swannies. But a lot of those glasses, they don't wrap round your face. So you've still got loads of blue light basically influencing these. But these new ones, they have a better curvature. So literally there's no artificial light that you can see. And I've been wearing them for about a week, but I'm sure I feel calmer. I feel sleepier earlier. I'm falling asleep quicker. It's really interesting.
Yeah, because I got a bit confused about all the blue light blocking glasses, because you have kind of like different colors for different. I'm like, what? What do I need? You know, so presumably you need the blue blockers in the day and the red ones at night to help you sleep. Is that the sort of thing?
My understanding is, you know, the more redder and darker the lens, the more they're blocking out, basically. So you know, the ones I've got are very kind of tinted, but you can get ones that just look like glasses, so they're see-through lenses, but they're blocking a slightly smaller frequency of just the blue lights. So people find if they're on a laptop for 10 hours they might get eye strain. So I used to wear a pair quite a lot when I was, you know, slave to my laptop, which I still am to a large degree, but they did make a difference.
Definitely. I mean, I had the Swanix, and literally I put the glasses on and I would literally pass out, you know. Literally, it's just like, he's Australian, so. But I'll tell you one more tip before we go on those. His sleep mask is £30. It's the best thing ever I've invested in the whole of my life. It's like completely silk. It's beautiful. Nice. And it's time for an upgrade on my sleep mask. I mean, meaning I need another one. It was the best investment. So, you know, I don't earn a penny from Swanix, nor do you, but or from these blue light blocking folk. But yeah, so anyway, we digressed as usual, because we were talking really about these other strategies.
Bringing that back is the fact that circadian biology is the foundation, or one of the foundations, of human health. So if you go onto PubMed and you start looking at circadian rhythm, and, you know, maybe add a third word, that could be, I was looking at research around GERDs. Just before our call, I was doing a webinar on GERDs, and there's research on our circadian rhythm from a GERD perspective. There's circadian rhythm and neurodegenerative conditions. There's circadian rhythm and autoimmune disease and cancers, and this concept of chronomedicine, the fact that the time of day you have your chemotherapy or you take your medication influences the efficacy of that treatment. So this is the other kind of real paradigm, I think, that's happening, which is, we again have evolved since when bacteria merged 14 billion years ago, or whenever it was, to live by a daylight cycle. And the majority of us in the population level barely experience pitch black anymore because of the lamps outside our bedroom windows. We live on roads and things. And it really is, I think, one of the biggest problems. And when you Ray Griffith's book, Mitochondria in Health and Disease, is an absolute must read, I think, for nutritional therapists. And he reminds us that, you know, when we eat food, that food has been absorbing light and it has contained that light in its structure. And what we do when we eat is we are breaking down that structure and releasing that light energy, which is created. So, you know, we are beings of light ultimately.
That's amazing. I mean, I remember sort of, you know, especially in the microbiome, how the bacteria communicate to the brain through photons of light. I just think that I hadn't sort of put two and two together to take it to the mitochondria. No, it's just like fascinating, isn't it, really? That, and also, you know, I suppose what you're saying really is to keep a really open mind about how some of these kind of modalities can be really dismissed. In, you know, if you went to really a conventional doctor, I mean, there are obviously loads of exceptions, but you sort of said, oh, by the way, you know, I don't know, light has a really important part in health. I mean, they'd probably just go, you're a nutter, you know, basically, because it's a materialist view. And it's all about the material, i.e., you know, coming back to, you've got this symptom, you know, we've got this medicine, and that's pretty much all we can suggest. Whereas this is really about the art of health as well as the science of health. And of course, the two are very important, but not to let one sort of almost take over the other. It's just getting that balance and keeping in the middle of that balance the person who's in front of you. No, definitely.
And, you know, as a nutritional therapist listening will be obviously very experienced and familiar with the dietary stuff that we can do. And research goes anything from 18% to 58% in regards to the role that diet influences the microbiome. So yes, we can obviously think about polyphenols, dietary fibers, diversity, eating in season, and eating locally, and these sorts of things that can be really helpful. And we can think about intermittent fasting or fasting as a way to support the microbiome. But don't forget that light, that movement, that stress management are all just as powerful. And in some of our clients are going to be more powerful than the dietary side of things. I mean, I have clients who are eating healthier than I am. You know, it's not a food thing that is driving their issues.
Yeah.
And then you have to, you know, have, I think, a long list of other tools and therapies that you can kind of lean on. And obviously,
because it can be an anxiety, you know, going back to what we were talking about, the health anxiety generally, and then gut, you know, health specifically, is that you can have somebody who's eating like, I remember a friend of mine who unfortunately died of cancer, but she sort of said, well, I'm sorry, but your career is rubbish, because the health editor of Vogue ate a healthy diet. She snuffed it at cancer. But the point is what kind of pressure was she under in that kind of environment? It's not really to do with the diet at that point. It might be to do with a whole lot of other stuff, as we've alluded to, you know, like not having the right light, not EMFs, which we haven't even touched on, obviously. All these different, you know, influences. And of course, it's easy to become paranoid and anxious because you're like, what have we thought of? What don't we know? You know, these are the things we do know. What do we don't know about? You know, so yeah. So listen, that's such a fascinating discussion. So in rounding off, what would you know, anything else you'd like to say on gut health, which we kind of wandered spectacularly off at various times? And lastly, give us the you know, where people can find the health path stuff again.
I guess the easiest way to answer that is if you go to healthpathpro.com, you can register, you'll get instant access. And then if you go to the resources tab, you'll kind of have your dashboard, as we call it. Go to the resources tab, that's where you will find dozens, if not hundreds, of resources that you can watch, read, and listen to. And last year I did a masterclass series on the gut microbiome. So on a weekly basis, we go through some of the key markers like pH in stool, secretory IgA, Akkermansia, microbiome diversity, what is it? What are the different types of microbiome diversity scores? So you have hours of education that can be watched there. And that's when we do deep dives into the specific things. So if you want to learn about methane and what we can do as a way to modify it while still understanding the root imbalances, then that masterclass and all of those kind of webinars are going to be hopefully a really great resource. My final point, because I just think it's really interesting, is research that's looked at the Hazda tribe over a year have found that their microbiome is wildly different. And again, this would make sense when you're eating and living seasonally. So in the dry months, their microbiome becomes more like that of a westernized individual, because there isn't as much plant matter in the dry season for them to eat. It's much more of a fatty animal produce diet. In the wet season, when there's a lot more plants, etc., their microbiome just goes and diversifies to the point that there are organisms that are undetectable in stool testing in the dry season, which are prominent in the wet season. And that shows us that there is a seasonality to all of this. And in fact, a term I didn't even know existed, I don't think, is circannual rhythms. You know, we talk too much about circadian, but actually, if we're talking about the role and power that light plays within all of this, well, the light spectrum changes and the amount of light we're exposed to changes. So really, should a lot of our testing have slightly different reference ranges based on the season? If nothing else, ones like cortisol, which obviously is one of the more potent circadian rhythms, which is going to change when we have longer days compared to shorter ones. So I've used that example a lot with clients when they are anxious about their microbiome, because it's like, look, this is natural that the diversity of organisms might not be there at times. It doesn't mean that you're at risk of X, Y, and Z, or that you're never going to get it back. We just need to support and actually cultivate health, resilience, diversity in your lifestyle as a way to see, ultimately. So again, you know, the idea of seasonal living and these oscillations that are just natural to life, we just need to return to a more natural way of living fundamentally.
Perfect. That is so interesting. I think we have to have you back, Alex, before too long, because it's been too long. And, you know, especially when maybe, you know, some of your mentoring programs are released, or if not before, to talk about some of your resources in your bank, because I'm sure nutritional therapists would be thrilled to be able to access those. So, well, for now, thank you, Alex, so much. Alex Manos, who's been talking to us today in a rambling conversation from me.
And me.
Because I was thinking, oh, great. Because the you know, obviously tribes are sort of, you know, the poor old, what are they called, the Hazda tribe, are so studied, poor things. They probably they probably just take the mick, you know. It's like another one of those researchers are coming, let's just do this, you know, because of course in anthropology, no, I'm only joking. But anyway, listen, lovely to speak to you. And yeah, so from Alex from Health Path, thank you so much, and yeah, go well, and thanks very much for your time.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.